And beyond that, where that little office used to belong to the light company, Smeesets own it, there was nothing there until you got to where Dr. Ellis' office is. He built, tore down a house there and built the office, and the next house where Dr. Ellis lives was where we first started housekeeping on our own in Sutton's Bay. But that was built by a man by the name of Ritter, and he was related to Ben Stimel, and Ben Stimel was a brother of John Stimel's. Ben was a butcher, and this man Ritter was a butcher, and they were worked at one time for Adolf Ruffley's dad, and I guess maybe they had a shop of their own for a short time. And this Ritter sold the house to C.P. Klein, who was a superintendent of schools there, and we bought it from Klein. Then we sold it to Harry Soggy. Harry Soggy sold it to Dr. Ellis.
Let's talk some on the docks.
Now, talking about the docks on the bay.
Yeah, we'll fill this tape up.
Over at Harold's farm, there is what was the Smith farm. There was a large dock there. Smith built in cordwood and bark, and also in potatoes. And vessels and steam barges used to land there. Then we went down along the bay to along where the village park is now. And there was a dock there that we always called the company dock. It really belonged to the W.S. Johnson Company, part of that layout. And this W.S. Johnson, they bought a lot of bark and cordwood and so on. And there was a boardwalk that led from where the depot is now all the way out along the street or road there, out to where the dock was. And they used to bring in this cordwood and bark and pile it on each side of that boardwalk until it was probably about, 6-8 feet high on each side of the thing. You walk down through that to going to this dock. They bought and traded it out with the farmers, and then these boats and vessels and steam barges would load there at the dock. Then there was the Grellick dock, which was connected with the Grellick mill, which the mill stood where the Northern Lumber Company is now. The dock is a present coal dock, only those days it was larger in area than it is now. It later was taken over by the boat company, the Northern Michigan Transportation Company, and later called the Northern Transit Company, I guess, or Michigan Transit Company. Anyway, the steamers from Chicago, the Missouri, the Illinois, the Puritan, so on, all landed there and discharged freight and took on a whale of a lot of potatoes. It was a great potato warehouse on that dock, a very large one. Then there was the Bailey dock. And the Bailey dock was in connection with Bailey's store. He shipped and bought and shipped quite a lot of potatoes. Vessels would load potatoes there at Bailey's dock. And also these steamers that we had on the bay before the railroad came. They used to make the rounds of all these docks. They stopped at Bailey's dock, they stopped at the company dock, and so on. Then over north of the Bailey dock was the Peterson dock, and that was in connection with Peterson's mill. That was a pretty good-sized dock. It was an L-shaped dock with the L sticking out to the north. And that was piled solid with lumber all the way out. And there again, the vessels and the steam barges would be loading. There would be sometimes several vessels laying out in the harbor waiting to dock. There wasn't room to get in so that they could load. And further along the shore, there was Leo Brothers had a mill that was shingle mill mostly. I think they cut some lumber also, but it was mostly shingles. And they had a small dock by their mill. That was back of Klump's present property. And then back of Dooster's. Dooster's, had, they had stores and so on in the early days up there, and they had a dock with warehouse on. As I recall it, when I was a youngster, I think I can still remember that being used a little bit, but it went out of use and just went to pieces. Then further north was, it was called the Stymo Dock. It was also called Seymour's Landing. As I recall, the place where Albert Anderson lives now was the Seymour Farm. Seymour sold to Eckerly, Ferdinand's father, and then Ferdinand's father sold to Albert Anderson's dad. But there was a dock there called the George Stymo Dock. And with a warehouse on, they used that for cordwood. They used it for potatoes. There were a lot of potatoes shipped out of there. I think that pretty well takes care of the different docks. Well, on the fires, Peterson lost two different mills there. The first mill he lost was one that he'd bought from George Stymo, Vic Stymo's dad. And that burned, I just can't think of when that burned, but it was a good-sized fire, of course, and the mill was rebuilt, and it burned again. And the final mill, this one that was standing now, I think must have been built about 19... possibly 1914, somewhere in there that was built. Then we had the Grellick Mill, which was a large mill down where the Northern Lumber Company is. It was operated by the Grellick brothers out of Traverse City. After they closed down as a sawmill, it stood vacant for a short time, and then a fellow from Ohio came up and started a stave factory. They made staves and heading pieces for butter tubs and things like that. He operated for a short time and went back to Ohio, and again stood vacant a short time when it was turned over into an Excelsior plant. People by the name of Karen and Dippenbrock that had an Excelsior mill. And that burned down, I think, about 1907 or 8. That was a terrific fire, and also took the what was called the Clark Potato Warehouse, which is now a warehouse used by the Northern Lumber Company, back to the drugstore. It almost took the Park Hotel at that time. The flames were heavy enough. They had to get a fire engine down from Traverse City, a steam fire engine that came down on the train. They had to run a special train down, put it down on the dock, and pump water on to save the rest of the buildings. We also had a fire on the Bailey Dock. That burned down, and there was a vessel at that time loading potatoes that was in quite late in the fall when that fire started, and the vessel was on fire too. They untied the thing and they pulled and shoved it away from the dock and got the fire put out. But the dock was pretty badly damaged by fire, and there was a whale of a lot of potatoes, of course, in the warehouse that were baked potatoes. And another bad fire we had was the livery stable back of the Park Hotel. That must have burned along about 1903-4, somewhere in there. That was a terrific fire. In the dead of winter, I think probably in February, colder than all get out, happened at night, and there were a lot of horses lost in that fire, and also the old man that was sort of the all-around boss of the livery stable. He had a little room in there that he slept in, and he was lost in that fire. The old Catholic church was another big fire that burned on Thanksgiving Day, but I don't remember the year. It must have been along about 1905, I would say, because we didn't have any water system yet. They had just a large size tank on wheels that operated like these brass ones do, with some sort of chemical. And trying to think of the other fires. I spoke about the Park Hotel fire, which was a bad one. I believe I spoke about it. It was amusing at that time because of the big bar they had in the Park Hotel, and I can remember some of these people that were helping carrying out the merchandise out of the bar that kept right on going, taking it right with them. The Roofley building, of course, that was another large fire. I think I'll have to.
Why not comment on the railroad? That ought to just about.
Well, the railroad was built, started in 1903, and saw it through in 1903. It was quite an operation because it was all handwork and horses. The only power machinery they had was a steam shovel that was up in a gravel pit back of Palmer's. And that's where they got the gravel for the ballast on the entire line. It was built from Hatches Crossing, connecting with the M&NE there at Hatches Crossing, and built on through to Northport. It was laid out originally, the way the story goes, by officials of the GRNI, which was part of the Pennsylvania system even those days. The GRNI means the Grand Rapids and Indiana Railroad. And these were supposed to be officials of the GRNI. GRNI ran through to Mackinac City, and they were not getting the freight they figured they should from across the straits. The Michigan Central had gobbled it all up that came across the straits, so they conceived the idea of building this road out to Northport and putting a ferry on from Northport to Manistique, which they did. They had a beautiful ferry at that time, I guess the largest ferry on the lakes. It ran for a few years, and there were a lot of freight trains, a lot of traffic on the road. They had a big pumping station on Leo Creek, just south of town, where they used to stop the freight trains to take on water, because they were hauling some fairly heavy freights. They had big yards, I suppose you'd call them marshaling yards, up at Omena. Around there they had a whale of a lot of track in there, where they would run these cars in waiting for the ferry so they could load them going north, or a lot of stuff that came off the ferry that they would have to hold there until they picked it up. But anyway, the road was built in 1903, and there was a big crew of Italians that was working on them. They had one big camp by Gus Barley's farm. There were a lot of trouble while they were here, a lot of fights, a lot of drinking and trouble. There were two killed back of what is now the Bay Hardware store, stabbed to death one Saturday night in a drinking brawl. They had another big camp up by Peshawby Town, and it was quite a thing for these general stores, especially those that had horses and delivery, because they went out to these places, took orders for supplies for the cook shanties, plus orders from the different people working on there, and then they would haul the stuff on. My oldest brother Martin was on the run for a while with working for Ellie Bailey on that trip to the camps with the merchandise. And the railroad, the ferry continued running for a number of years until, as the story goes, the Michigan Central decided that they would divide up the freight coming across the straits, and this road was, or this ferry was discontinued. It was a bad blow to Northport, naturally a bad blow to the whole line, because it employed a lot of section men to keep the track in shape. And they continued operating the road. The GRNI operated the road until I believe it was the spring of 1912, either 1911 or 12, but I think it was 1912, they operated, and then the TCLM, the Traverse City Leelanau Manistique, which was supposed to have been the company that built it, they took it over on their own. And the story goes on by some of the old-timers that the Michigan Central was the one that got the TCLM out of hock so that they could take the road back. And I do remember all the equipment that the TCLM had, their engines, their coaches, and everything. You could see underneath the paint Michigan Central. Of course, Michigan Central is now the New York Central, but you could see the MC railway.
You take the flank of beef and split it into as many pieces as it will divide in with the tissue on the back of each piece that will hold it together when you're through. And you lay out the meat and put pieces of lean beef and pieces of fairly lean fresh pork on, and then you add the other seasoning, which is salt, pepper, thyme, allspice. I see. What's the rest of it? And a very little saltpeter, just a pinch of saltpeter. And there's some. I don't know. Stop it. Onion salt is the other seasoning that you put in there. Then you take and roll this up into a tight roll, keeping the tissue on the outside, and sew it securely. And after you have it all sewed, you tie it around the roll several times, so be sure it holds very solid. And then it is put in cold water to cover in a crock and leave it for 24 hours. Then you pour this cold water off and put an equal amount of brine, which is made by, for each gallon of water, you use a pound of brown sugar and 2 pounds of salt and a little saltpeter, and bring it to a boil and simmer it for 30 minutes. For 15 minutes instead of 30 minutes, and let it cool and skim, and then pour it over the meat in the crock and put a weight on it to hold it down, and let it stand for at least 2 weeks, occasionally stirring it around to stir up the brine. And then you put it on in cold water to cover in a kettle and cook it slowly as you would corned beef until you can pierce it with a fork very easy, and put it on a plate or platter and put another one on top of it and put a weight on it and let it cool that way to weigh it down real well, because that pinches it together and makes it easier to slice when it's cold. That's the dough.
Now call it rule.
This is Norwegian meat roll, or rule, as it is called.
Well, this is Christmas Day 1961 in Okemos, and the folks are down visiting. So we're going to add just some random thoughts about family background, this time on mother's side. I might put in here on the recipe for rule a point that should be observed strictly, is that when the rool is cooked, it should not be cooked in an aluminum container. Or when you make the brine, it should not be made in an aluminum container, in earthenware or stainless steel. I'd now like to have Mother put down some thoughts about the beginnings of the Heimfrith family, both here in Michigan, and if you can get something down about where they were generally located in Germany, why add that.
While I think of it, there is one thing that I wanted to bring up, and just reminds me, this Christmas, I knit each one of the grandchildren a pair of mittens, and Grandpa put some money in them. That was what used to happen when I was a youngster. My Grandma Heimfrith always knit us mittens for Christmas, and Grandpa had to get in onto the present also, so he would put money in our mittens. They came from Germany. Grandpa came from near Koblenz, and a little town on the Rhine, and Grandma was an orphan and came from Berlin originally, but she was sent to this country when she was just a young girl to some relatives, and where she used to be more or less of a glorified servant. She was not treated too well, and as soon as she was old enough to get away from the place where she was, she went to work in a boarding house in New Jersey, and that was where she met Grandpa, and they were married. He was several years older than she was, and was a very strong, sturdy person. He's everyone that I've ever heard tell about him in his younger days was what a powerful man he was, and full of ambition. The grandmother's name, her maiden name, was Zimmerman, Elizabeth Zimmerman, and Grandpa's name was George Frederick Heimforth, which we didn't know. He was always called Fritz, and we didn't know that that was his full name until my brother George was named George Frederick, and he told us then that that was his full name. Well, after they were married, they lived in New Jersey for a couple of years, and they went back to Germany on the sailing vessel. And Grandmother always told about that horrible trip that they had coming back to America. She had a small baby at that time, and they were 6 weeks laying outside New York Harbor that they couldn't get in because of the storm. And she never had any desire to go back to Germany after that. She never would even consider it. Well, after they got back, a short time, they came to Chicago and took the boat up the lakes, and they settled on North Manitou Island. And that was about in the 1850s, because or thereabout, I can't just remember, but I know that after they were there a short time, Grandpa went west on the gold rush. He left the island and had his ox team and his equipment, and was gone for nearly a year, and come back with barely the shirt on his back. And in the meantime, Grandma lived on the island with several small children. Some of them were born there on the island. And that was at the time of King Strang and his gang on Beaver Island, and they used to come down and raid the Manitous. So they had to keep their stuff hid out in the woods. And Grandmother, by the way, was a very short, small person, but she must have been built of iron because of all the things that she withstood in her pioneer days. She'd had to have been made of tougher stuff than I am in order to have lived through it. But shortly after he come back from the gold rush, they moved to the mainland of Leelanau County and homesteaded the old home there, which is still in the Heinfeth name, is still and is now due for one of these 100-year citations, because it's been in the same family all those years. And they raised their family and cleared their land and built a real nice home and spent the rest of their years there. Dad was next to the youngest in the family, and they had 8 children all together. The oldest was Elizabeth, who passed away when she was just a young woman. There was William and Philip, Peter, Catherine, and Frederick, George, Lena, and Minnie, or her name was really Wilhelmina, but they always called her Minnie. And I remember so well, we lived just, did I get Peter?
You got Peter, but you didn't get Mrs.
Carter. Yes, I did, Catherine. We lived just above Grandpa's place up the hill, and of course it was such a short ways to their place that I think I probably spent a good share of my real young days down there, because Aunt Minnie and Aunt Lena were young folks there, and they just sort of took us under their wing, and we were more or less like dolls in their eyes, I guess. But it was a very happy time. We always look forward to going down to Grandpa's and Grandma's house and spent a lot of time there. And of course, Grandma always had coffee cake, which was to us about the best thing in the world. And Grandpa always had a bag of candy back in the bedroom. I can still see how we'd wait for him to go back to this beautiful walnut highboy that they had in the bedroom there. And in this one particular drawer was our candy, but we always got some if we'd wait for Grandpa to come and get it. But believe me, if anybody had gone in there on their own, it would have been just too bad, because he would have really cut us down. But the one thing I remember so well, when we used to eat there, Grandpa was very fond of Limburger cheese. And what I mean was, it was the real bona fide Limburger cheese, and it, to me, it was about the worst, world's worst smelling thing that I ever come up against. And when that Limburger cheese come out, I usually would find an excuse to get away from the table. But Grandpa also had his own bee house. He kept his own bees and had his own honey. And I remember so well that the bees swarmed one day on him and got into the well house. And he was in there trying to get them out, trying to get them back where they belonged. And of course, they were a bit on the sassy order, and he was getting stung, and we kids were standing by the fence watching the performance, and we thought it was funny because he was getting stung, and started to laugh. And I can still see how furious he got at us and chased us out of there because we were making fun of him. But they were real pioneers, there was no question about it. Another thing I remember, my grandfather, he never walked across the farm but he carried a lightweight grub hole. And any weed, anything like that, that shouldn't be there, it sure got the axe in a hurry, because he just could not stand to see anything like that. I remember the telling about when Grandpa first came to the present farm, the place that they went to shop was Leland, and he would take his pack on his back and walk along the lake shore, which was a regular Indian trail along there. Lake Leelanau is the name of the lake, and would walk to Leland and carry back his groceries on his back, which, well, it wasn't so much when you stop to think of all the things that they raised on the farm. They were pretty well self-sufficient, and there wasn't any equipment that you needed to make things for your living there, but what Grandpa seemed to have, and he always took such good care of it. In the old country, he had learned shoemaking also, which was quite interesting, because Dad's father was a shoemaker, and when he came from the old country, it was funny that we would happen to be two shoemaking families get together. But I also recall, when I was a youngster, of Grandpa going into Traverse in the later years. He had a beautiful, what they called a phaeton, a top buggy, and it was just kept so shiny and pretty, and that was really an occasion when we got a chance to ride in this lovely rig. But he had a team that were very high-spirited and took some very careful handling, but Grandpa would take off for Traverse and do the shopping in the later years. And I can still hear him when he came home, in order to get the horses unhitched and to help take care of things, he would always call Grandma, and I can still hear him call Lucy, just as plain as though it was only yesterday, and that is 60-some years back now. But we never knew that any of Grandpa's relatives came to this country until after he passed away. Some way, the notice was in the papers, and some of the relatives that were in Milwaukee, which was his sister and her family, happened to notice that this notice of his passing, and they contacted us, and after that we got to be quite friendly with them. But I do remember of hearing them tell about the rest of the relatives in Germany sending over to Grandpa for money that they would want to come to this country, but they never came until he got to the point that he was all fed up on sending the money anymore, because they were just figured that he was worth a fortune, and they were pulling his leg, in other words. The farm he homesteaded, and as I said before, they are going to present the papers now and have this 100-year citation. His farm was about 120 acres, and the one thing that I recall so well was when the railroad went through, they cut the farm right cornerways, and he never was reconciled to that. He fought it to the last ditch and hated that railroad from the day it started to run, and was always so sure that some of we youngsters were going to be killed on the railroad. And the day that he passed away, he was sitting in his chair looking out the window, counting the freight cars that went by. In those days, there were some real freight trains went through, because they went to Northport, and the cars went across the lake on the ferry. And he dropped over with a heart attack as he sat there counting those freight cars. Our neighbors that we have in the immediate community there were Britons, which were the closest neighbors, Beitners, Warners, Clarks, Fishers, and this region or valley that we had there was called Pleasant Valley, which was a very appropriate name for it. By the way, the schoolhouse that sits on the corner there, that was the former schoolhouse, was Grandpa gave them the land for that and gave them a 99-year lease, which must be pretty nearly up by this time. And he also set aside a small corner of his farm in which there is the Hindforth Cemetery, and that was put there when there wasn't a burial place anywhere around. And there is another youngster from another family that is buried there. There are not too many people buried in this cemetery, but Grandpa and Grandma, of course, are buried there, and an uncle, Frederick, and Aunt Lizzie, who died when she was quite young, and my sister, Lola, and a little youngster of Aunt Lena and Uncle Emery's. Weekend. And that, I don't think that altogether, or Arville Hindforth is buried there too. He was Frederick Hindforth's son. He died in California and was shipped back here and buried back in about 1911. But the cemetery is supposed to be left as is. There's been some talk in the last few years about abandoning it, but they have just recently got together, and the Boy Scout troop from Leland is taking care of it and keeping it up, and it looks quite respectable now. There are so many things that come to mind as you sit and think back over the years that it's hard to know where to start, but I do feel that we came from real pioneer stock, because when I think of the hardships that our folks put up with in order to establish a home, as I said before, they were made of pretty sturdy stock, or they could never have survived, because they just chopped their home right out of the wilderness. My dad spoke about going to school mornings and meeting up with bear and deer and all sorts of things, but they seemed to be able to manage some way or other.
Where was your father born?
Dad was born on the farm there.
Do you recall any particular friendships they had with neighbors, or any neighbors that were with whom they had any animosity?
Oh my, yes. They, Grandpa was really, he was a hard-bitten Dutchman with a heart as big as all our doors. When you really got through to it, there was no question about it, but he had a very distinct dislike for Catholics. That was poison in his book. And there were some of the neighbors that were from Germany that were definitely Catholics. And you take the Lautners, some of the Lautners up on the county line, who normally you would have thought would have been just very good neighbors, but because of that reason, they didn't neighbor with them. But another thing that Grandpa had an awful aversion to was perfume. He just couldn't stand perfume. And if anyone came around that had any perfume on, he wasn't above inviting him to get out or the air would take over. He had a favorite expression, and it was so funny. We kids used to get such a bang out of it. He'd go sniffing around and he'd say, "What the devil stinks so?" And after having that Limburger cheese around, I never could understand why that he didn't have the same feeling against that, but he didn't seem to notice that that was smelling.
Do you recall any birth dates in there?
I remember of Grandpa having, there's one table that sat by the window, and on this he had his big Bible, and he used to sit in what you call a captain's chair. That I would give my eye teeth to have a chair like that, because it just brings back memories of seeing him sit there with his glasses sometimes shoved up on his forehead, and when he wanted to read, he'd pull them down so that he could see better. And he would sit there in his later years by the hour and reading the Bible and talking and visiting. He had some very, very definite ideas, and it was pretty hard to change his thinking in any way, shape, or manner, which I suppose is a characteristic of the nationality, but it kind of catches up with all of us as the years go by. But he surely provided a very comfortable home for his family. Another thing that I recall as I sit here was his aversion to having anything artificial. That to him was just absolutely poison. And my grandmother and my aunt in the winter, when the cream didn't have the coloring in it that it has in the summer, would want to color the butter a little bit so that it wouldn't be so white. And he absolutely would not let them buy regular butter coloring, so they used to scrape carrot and take the juice and color the butter with that without his knowing anything about it. And he also had some choice apple trees. And by the way, there is one old spy tree that is still producing in the yard that is near as we can figure out. That tree is over 100 years old, and when the hurricane went through there 3 years ago, or the tornado, it took about three quarters of this tree down, but this year it had the grandest crop of beautiful red spies that you could ever hope to see. And this particular tree was Grandpa's pride and joy. He always thought so much of that tree, and we were just talking this fall about what a wonderful thing that was, that that tree was still producing. And as far as it looks, if the tornado doesn't come through again, it'll go on for many, many years.
Were there any particular sons or daughters that were favorites of his that would make him
best? Yes. They always tell about my dad, who was George, was sort of the pet of the family. And he was always accused, rightly or wrongly, I don't know, of bearing tales to Grandpa, things that he really shouldn't have done, in as much as when Grandpa would be gone for the day and anything would go wrong that he didn't think that should have been done, he would tell Grandpa about it when he got home. And one day, luckily, my grandmother happened to catch him just in time where the rest of them were going to have revenge, and they had him strung up. They had him hung. And if Grandma hadn't come around just when she did, I don't suppose I would have been here. But he survived the ordeal. And another thing I remember with my dad and my Aunt Sophie, who was very much of a favorite with me, they could imitate and put on a show, and they used to do that to entertain the bunch. They could imitate anybody, and it was just really funny to hear my dad take off and imitate the neighbors. One was John Warner, who was odd sort of a person. And Dad could take off and mock him to a T, and one day he made a recording of this make-believe conversation that he had with John Warner, and they played it back for him, for John Warner, and he wouldn't believe it. He didn't know, of course, anything about it, but he was sure that that was himself talking, and it was Dad all the while that was imitating. And I see our Eddie has acquired one of Dad's tricks. He's able to wiggle his ears. Dad used to entertain us by the hour, wiggling his ears and his scalp, first one and then the other. I think Ed has taken that ability to imitate from Grandpa. Oh, we often talk about how we spent our nights, our evenings when we were young, without any radio, without any TV, without any cars, without a whale of a lot of extra things that they have today. But we had a very happy time. Everybody worked at our house, but after our work was done, then we had fun. And we used to, in the evenings, in the winter, when it was cold outside, our beans that we sold had to be hand-picked. And Dad would bring a bag of beans in on this big table that we had, dump it out, and all hands would turn to and sort beans. When we got the beans done, then we would lots of times make candy, popcorn. We had big bowls of apples. We'd play different kinds of games, and Mother loved to read, and sometimes she would sit and read a book to us, and we just enjoyed it so much. By 9:30, everybody was in bed because we had to be up with the crack of dawn, and or before that. And we would go out skating. We used to have a big gang around our corner there that we'd get together and we'd go down to the lake, which was a mile. We'd walk down, we'd skate across the lake when the ice was good, which is about 3 miles.